Derry, I guess this room, which is, I mean, so revealing of the period of this piece and the history of the characters is all over the walls, will soon be humming to that very particular Tennessee Williams heartbreak. You and your director, Joe Hill Gibbons, are in the thick of rehearsals here in Deepest Kilburn for what I believe is your first theatre score for many, many years.
Many years.
You did Dr. Faustus at the RSC in the 90s.
It's definitely more than 15 years, and I've spent the last 15 years concentrating on movies.
You certainly have, and your stock has been rising there with an Oscar and a Golden Globe.
I've been very lucky. But in fact, I started with theatre, and that still has a very big place in my heart. It was played by Garcia Lorca. It was called Donna Rosita the Spinster. I was playing on stage every night with two other musicians, and it was a wonderful experience. It was probably the third or fourth play I was doing the music for. But in that particular one, an actor was going out with one of the actresses in the play. And he came to see the play, and he was working on a movie. And he got a tape of my music for the play and passed it to his director. And before I knew, I was in my first feature film.
That's how it happens, I didn't
have a clue what I was doing, really. I was terrified.
So what are the fundamental differences between writing for the theatre and writing for film? I mean, is the process similar, beginning with the discussions with the director about what you might...
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the fundamental similarities are that it's about storytelling, and you have to find a way with other people to tell a story. So it's a joint effort to find the best way to tell a story. The main difference is that very often, to pull the music out of a movie will result in the movie becoming a bit awkward, and a lot of scenes will be very hard to watch without music. And I think it's very often the opposite in the theatre, that the moment you put too much music in the theatre, or it's a much more delicate balance. And I'm not really sure about, you know, why that should be. I have thought about it, but it's something that has to do, I think, with the different type of suspension of disbelief that we have in the theatre.
Yes, and the fact that you can't cut to close-ups, and you can't, you're presented with the entire play, aren't you? And the narrative goes from start to finish, and you can't play tricks.
Yes,
well, stylization.
We hope to play some tricks in the Glass Menagerie, but I think the cinema strives to realism, possibly more, and there is not that pretension in the theatre where you can see the building, the stage, the lighting. It is a very obvious contrivance.
Yes.
And so why should music, which is a contrivance, should feel out of place? I'm not quite clear.
Obvious question about the play is, are you using music simply as a device to carry the emotional mood forward between scenes, or are you actually using underscoring?
I think it's both in this play, and one of the reasons that attracted me to this particular play and made me think I really want to do this and go back to doing some theatre is that the way the music is written into the script by Tennessee Williams is very unusual. So, for example, in the very opening of the play, the main character who arrives on stage announces that he's got musicians in the wings that will help him producing this memory play. He spells it out for the audience. In memory, everything seems to happen to music, and that's the reason for the musicians here. Now, that's very unusual. Mm. My experience of theatre mostly is that the musicians are either in the wings, literally, or hidden away in the pit. They're not actually called to help the main character, by the main character, to help build in a memory that character wants to present the audience with. It kind of reminded me very much of some Pirandello theatre. Pirandello wrote a number of plays where the actors address the audience as actors, not as the characters that they are acting out. Somehow they instigate or they encourage a relationship between the viewer and the stage. The whole thing becomes so layered. So you're watching fiction, but some of the characters in the fiction are aware that is fiction and they're taking you by the hands. And
well, there's also, with all Tennessee Williams plays, this wonderful delicate balance between the foundation in reality with observations of the period that are very precise and this dreamlike quality. Right. Some of the language is extremely poetic, and I guess that again ties in with what you might do with music.
There are a number of instructions by Tennessee Williams in the play that I can't find the right word, except that the expression over the top comes into my mind. He goes into a great detail, for example, describing how the main theme of the play should work, which is all very well, but you can only talk so much about music. It's you can't really put something in words, and it's almost, as you read what he's after, you can almost see a certain desperation that he wants to describe in words something that really can't be described in words. And I think one of the main ideas of the play that is reflected in the music that we are preparing for this production is the idea that the glass is, I can't find the word now, it's a symbol. The glass is a symbol
of fragility.
Of fragility, and particularly of Laura's fragility, one of the characters of the play. And it's always on the edge of breaking. It's delicate, but it's also beautiful.
It was that lovely moment where the unicorn breaks, the horn breaks off, and she says, exactly. Now he's just a horse like
exactly.
all the others. And that mythology element as well. I mean, Williams does layer it on, doesn't he?
Yeah. So I felt that it would be appropriate to try to extend that metaphor to the music, and so there will be a fair amount of glass in our kit.
With an idea, for example, in Atonement, the typewriter was very key.
I don't necessarily do it every single time I get a new project. I sit down to think, what is the sound that sums it up? But occasionally, it seems obvious to me that there is a sound that we should use. And in The Glass Menagerie, not using glass seems it's counterintuitive. In fact, I don't think it's been used a lot.
I've seen two or three productions, and I've never encountered that. The paradox in this room, of course, is that all the animals are plastic at the moment for rehearsal purposes.
Course, yes.
But we're sitting, Dario, near a glass harmonica, which I guess was one of those rarely used instruments that would...
Well,
such an extraordinary sound.
Yeah, in fact, it's covered at the moment, so you can't see quite what's inside this box, but it's glasses, it's crystal glasses. The glass harmonica as an instrument was, as you probably know, invented by Benjamin Franklin in the 18th century. And it originally, I thought we would try to use that, but we found that with the glasses and with larger crystal balls, we have a larger range of sounds.
Okay.
And so that's what we're using. But the sound of the glass and the glass harmonica has been associated with madness very quickly.
Lucia di Lammermoor.
Exactly. And apparently, immediately after the invention of the glass harmonica by Benjamin Franklin, where did he find the time to do all this? It became extremely popular. And then reports started coming in of people going mad listening to that instrument. So the fade passed very quickly. It was not so trendy anymore, but a fair amount of music was written for it. And it seemed particularly appropriate that Laura, one of our characters, is a very unusual girl, not to say a little mad, but she's a little bit too close to the edge of potential madness, and we don't quite know what will happen to her after the end of the play. The sound of glass seemed appropriate.
We're actually sitting near a table, which is a table of wonders. It's got the inside of a piano on it. Presumably, yeah. You will have bowed glasses. There are things like... I could have a ball here, actually.
You could, I'm
yeah,
sure.
So tell us about some of this stuff, and how many instrumentalists are you using, and is all the music written down, or is it just improvised?
It's two musicians. There's a pianist... who will be Eliza McCarthy, and a percussionist, Simon Allen, with whom I've worked many, many times in the past on various things, on ballet, on movies. It's the first time we worked together on a theatre piece. The last time we worked together was on Terry Gilliam's Brothers Grimm, where I asked Simon to help me create the crazy sounds for the Enchanted Forest of that movie. Whenever I think of Simon, I think of him as somebody who's got one mission in life, which is to come up with new sounds that are quite crazy and arresting. So every time I need some craziness, I always call him. On Brothers Grimm, he actually started making instruments for me out of curtain wires and cardboard boxes and all sort of things. So we spent a couple of days in the recording studio and go fishing for sounds, really. And we thought, of course, you know, we're still in rehearsal and things are very fluid at this moment, they're changing. But I thought it would be wonderful to try to have quite a lot of the sound effect that the play calls for, including thunderstorms and rain and chimes and various other noises, to turn them into something that is more stylized. And because the play is memory and because it's all in somebody's mind, really, it seemed appropriate to me that we wouldn't use sound effects that are recorded in very high quality and and at the press of a button, but we would make them as the character would have to make them in his own mind while he's recollecting. So a lot of what you see here probably will be recruited for that purpose.
It's quite unusual to actually see a rehearsal room where the musical elements are, you know, part of the rehearsal process, part of the process of making the play.
Yeah, I believe you're right. This partially comes from my desire, and I do these on movies as well, to be involved as early as possible with the process. And I've discovered over the years that the results that I get by working that way and somehow try to get under the skin of the animal as the animal is growing are always more satisfactory in the end for me than arriving at the last minute and applying the paint on the skin.
So you start writing in movie scores before you've seen the finish?
If I have the chance, yes. I mean, on Atonement that you mentioned before, I started writing music before the film was shot. In fact, before the script was even finished.
Well, that must be a very special relationship with a director to be able to do that.
I think it is, and not all directors will be up for this. They probably don't have the mental space to engage with music until quite late in the process, and so I'd say most movies end up having the composer being called the very late stage. I now have a relationship with some producers and some directors going back a few years, so they know that I quite like being involved early, so they call me early now.
Is it all going to be written down eventually or not? I mean, presumably the percussion elements will be...
Very early on, I recorded a reading of the play, and it was extremely rough, but it gave me some very rough timings, and I actually wrote the score in its entirety. Now, this sounds crazy, because, of course, there's no way that what I've written is going to fit what the actors are going to do, except that I thought it would be a good idea on this to have some music written and then come into rehearsal with that music. And then as I sit at the piano and we start putting scenes that the actors have rehearsed, I start making changes and I drop sections, and also there are suggestions coming from Joe, from the actors, and so the idea is that eventually I rewrite it all with all this cuts and edits and corrections and new ideas.
Fantastically creative process, which you don't find that often. Is there anything in the period of this piece? Because it's a very rich period for music, and there's an old wind-up gramophone down there with an old 78 that you've used.
Well, in the music that I have written, there isn't really. It really tries to connect to deeper human character. It's more universal and less time constrained. However, because the play is placed in the 30s, in the late 30s, and is remembered from point of view of mid-40s probably, looking back, there's some music. For example, there's a dance hall across the road, and so we hear music drifting in from the windows, and that's music from the time. Some of it, it's very specifically exactly what Tennessee Williams specifies in the script, and some other pieces we choose things that we thought would go better with what the actual movements and the action requires in our production, but they are pieces from, dance pieces from the 1930s.
So you reckon you'll have a score by first night, do you? It's kind of...
I better have.
Do you work... You talked about the piano in relation to this, but how do you generally work? Do you work on a keyboard, or do you work on a computer program, or both?
Both. It's a keyboard attached to a computer program. Yeah. Very occasionally, I'll go to my piano, to my real piano, and I've got a bit of music paper on the stand in front of me, and I'll scribble some ideas. They are always very, very rudimentary, basic ideas if I'm at the real piano. What happens with the keyboard connected to the computer is what Schumann wished he had but didn't. He wanted something to record his improvisations, and that's exactly what the computer does. So I'll start bouncing ideas in my head and put my hands on the keyboard and I start improvising.
From everything you've said, Dario, you obviously like to collaborate. You're a collaborator. You're part of this room today. You're part of... I mean, I can't think of when I last encountered a composer who was actually part of the rehearsal process.
Really?
It's kind of rare in the theatre. I was in the theatre for 8 years, right, and I never saw a composer come anywhere near a rehearsal room.
And I might be overdoing it. I can see that... I can see that Joe and the actors need a lot more space on their own before I can come in. But at the same time, you're right, I like collaborating. I enjoy making music with other people. And having the pressure to think on the spot and change things on the spot. And one of my most pleasurable 2 weeks of my life, I think, came out of... that's where I met Simon Allen, our multi-instrumentalist, by the way. We were in Bretton Hall in a camp, summer camp, for 2 weeks, and it was seven composers, seven choreographers, about 30 dancers, and about 12 musicians.
Gosh.
Every day, each composer would work with a different choreographer to create a piece that we would have to show in the evening with dancers and musicians. So in the space of half a day, you would have to find a story, collaborate with the choreographer, go off, write the piece, get the musicians, rehearse it, then put it together with the dancers. And it was unbelievably rewarding for me.
Because one usually thinks the composers are solitary people, doesn't one? And I guess you've obviously written concert music as well. Is that what drew you to film and theatre?
That's possibly true. I remember feeling very lonely writing concert music. In one occasion, I spent a year writing an orchestral piece and doing very little else, becoming increasingly frustrated. And definitely is one of the reasons why I loved doing ballet and theatre and then cinema.
What have you got in the pipeline after this experience? So you've got movies on the go at the moment.
Yes, I'm just starting on a couple of things. I'm always reading scripts, and there is a project or two that are starting right now.
Is that how it happens now? Now that you're, with that profile you've built in film, people contact you and send you scripts as opposed to a director coming to you and saying, well,
no, both. I think it happens both ways. It was happening even before the official blessing, you know, from the Oscars. I think that was a very...
way of putting it, the official blessing.
Yes. There was a very exposed moment and a very wonderful one. But in fact, prior to that, I was receiving very interesting offers and I worked on very good movies. Yeah, I feel extremely fortunate. I seem to attract the very kind of director that I want to attract.
Yes, well, that's a big thing, because otherwise you're in the situation of, you know, do you want it good or do you want it Tuesday?
Yes.
As Andre Breton once said.
I seem to end up working with very gifted and intelligent directors who are interested in a dialogue with the composer.
And this is live music as well, isn't it, in this show?
Yes.
Because so often it is recorded. I think this is an important element. And it must alter the dynamic of what you're doing. So will there be any room for improvisation in the performance?
I'm sure there will be, in order to stay with the delivery of the actors, which might change from one night to the other. So hopefully we'll be able to pull that off with some tricks.